Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Literary Studies. I am John Yargo, your host. Coins, flax, spinning wheels, mud, pigs. Each of these objects were ubiquitous in the pre-modern cultural representation of the Irish. Through case studies of these five objects, Colleen Taylor's new monograph, Irish Materialisms, The Non-Human and the Making of Colonial Ireland, 1690 to 1830, just out from Oxford University Press, recovers the sometimes oppressive, sometimes liberatory meanings invested in non-human matter. Irish Materialisms collects a rich archive of material from William Carleton's Phil Purcell, the Pig Driver, to the It narrative, The Adventures of a Bad Shilling in the Kingdom of Ireland, Gulliver's Travels, to Sidney Owenson's The Wild Irish Girl. Colleen Taylor is professor of English at Boston College. She has held the National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship at the University of Notre Dame and an Irish Research Council postdoctoral award at University College Cork. Irish Materialisms is her first monograph. Welcome to the podcast, Colleen. Congratulations on the publication of Irish Materialisms.
Thank you, John. So great to be here. Thanks for having me.
First, I'd like to start with a question about objects themselves outside of the context of your book. You talk about objects that object, objects that resist the stories that we tell about them and about other cultures. Can you tell us about an object that objects in your own experience?
Yeah, I was actually thinking a lot about objects today in preparation of our chat and which ones are meaningful to me just in my life. And I think the one that for some reason was kept coming up to my coming to mind was my daughter's baptismal robes, which sounds kind of bizarre, but it kind of links with what I talk about in the preface of the book. But so I just had a baby 6 months ago, and we got her baptized in Belfast over Christmas. My husband's from Belfast, and I brought the baptismal robes that my family had used for over 100 years now. So dating back to my great grandmother, I think was the one that initially got them for her children. And it just felt like this kind of strange circle about the endurance of materiality. So like, I never met those particular ancestors or whatever. I barely know their names. But this material has lasted through the generations. All my cousins were baptized in it. I was baptized in it. It objects in the sense that, those old histories fall away. You know, we lose track of our great-great-grandparents or our great-grandparents or whatever. But I think that material object sort of resists that decline of the past. It seems really enduring, and it holds a lot of material significance to me, and more so now that I've reflected on its longevity, I suppose. So, yeah.
I guess the robe also kind of captures this migration out and then migration back, you know?
Yes. Yeah. It felt very cyclical too. Because it would have been bought by the first generation that came over to the States from County Clare in Ireland, which is where my mom's family is from. And now, yeah, I was kind of bringing it back up north, not to Claire. I'm sure the Claire ancestors weren't happy about that, but nevertheless, bring it back to the island anyway.
That's a wonderful transition because I wanted to ask you about the reflection at the start of your book. And in this preface, you make a compelling case for leaning into owning our personal connections to the material we work with rather than presupposing a kind of a scholarly distance from the material. Tell us about the stakes of the personal in your own work.
Yeah, that was actually the last bit that I wrote, and I did kind of go back and forth about it. I was like, oh, this doesn't feel very like academic or very scholarly. It doesn't feel like it belongs in the normal type of academic books I read. But for better or worse, I was actually writing the book as my mother was dying from cancer, and so I was reflecting a lot on like, I guess it's essentially like, what's the point of life? What's the purpose of life? What do our lives mean? And I think as I was thinking about all those things, thinking through those things, the materials of the book, which were at one stage just an academic question, started to gain more of like narrative personal significance for me. And just thinking about history and life and fleetingness, but also what remains and what endures. And I think it just sort of like it just naturally sort of poured out of me one day. And yeah, and then after I wrote it, I was kind of like, you know what, there's something significant in this. It adds, I guess it doesn't try to make me like a impartial blind author, but someone who is invested in it. And I think it's nice to kind of share more personal stories in scholarship. It's not a natural thing to do. I mean, I know there's sort of like this new emerging genre of the scholarly autobiography, which is kind of exciting to me too. I don't think that's necessarily what I was trying to do, but nevertheless, I think all of our projects become personal to us, and we questions that we raise in regard to an article or a book or whatever, they oftentimes have an autobiographical origin. So, yeah, why not embrace that, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like one of those ironies, I think, with scholars of like we do so much work cultivating this image that we're just kind of like indulging in like some arcane topic that is, distant from us. And yet, someone sees our work or comes across it and they're like, oh yeah, and they know us a little bit and they immediately see, oh yeah, this is like so deeply personal,
There's a little bit of our own characters in everything we write, even if we're being very impartial researchers.
Yeah, absolutely. And which makes sense. I mean, we spend, almost a decade on these, but, we're
I know.
right. So, yeah, absolutely. I'm aligned with you on that.
Thank you.
Your book is invested in the capacity of material objects to offer counter histories and counter stories. You pick these five objects that are just like wonderfully well selected, I think. Coins, flax, spinning wheels, mud, pigs. How did you choose those objects? Did they come to you at the start of the project? Did they like announce themselves to you? Or did you arrive at them through experimentation? Were there other objects that you tried writing about that you ended up, discarding?
So both actually, some of them were there from the start. So the coin, for instance, was that was it was the first ch major chapter or case study, and it was the first one that I interacted with because I read that It narrative, The Adventures of a Bad Shilling in the Kingdom of Ireland, and I was interested in the It narrative, 18th century literary genre. So that one was kind of first, and then the other ones, they announced themselves to me as I was reading and just reading a bunch of Irish novels from the 18th century. These things kept recurring and recurring, these tropes. The last two chapters came later, as I think I was getting more of a sense of what the project was actually about and sort of raising the stakes of it a little bit. And so I wanted to deal with the most egregious stereotype against Irish people in the 18th and into the 19th century, which is that they're kind of just dirty, mud wallowing pigs essentially, and they live in mud and they're filthy and animal and all this kind of stuff. That's the worst of the worst. So I think I sort of like grew toward those bigger stakes materials. And then I did have other ones that I got rid of. I had the similar sort of sartorial objects. I got rid of clothing over time. I think I wanted to just focus on really everyday objects or things that are democratizing in their sort of the way that they circulate among everybody. So not something necessarily that is going to be sustained or held in a museum or discussed in a sort of a typical material culture book, but something that's just your everyday materiality that the lowest members of society up to the elite would have at least encountered or come into contact with on a weekly basis, I suppose. So something that connects everyone in society.
Okay, that's yeah, I see that. Now the way each of these objects circulates and is like a an object of transmission and interconnection.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. You wonderfully illuminate in that first chapter that you just alluded to the significance of coins in Irish history and literature. These are a few of the things I learned from your chapter. Coins are literal signifiers of the imposition of English power onto Irish colonial subjects. Coins were the site of anxieties about authenticity and forgery. Coins trafficked in gendered images of feminized Ireland. And coins circulated widely while also claiming physical intimacy with people who kept them in their pockets, their hands, and so on. If they could speak, what would coins say about the early modern colonial project in Ireland?
That's a great question. Well, the funny part is that I argue that coins do speak in that chapter. At least they do it in that one tale that I talk about, The Adventures of a Bad Shilling. The main character is a shilling. It's not a person. What would they say? I think they would. For some reason, I think them as kind of humorous. I think of them as like having a laugh a little bit at all of these sort of human foibles that are being expressed back and forth or on the surface of a coin. You know, are we impressing it with this amount of value or that amount of value, this national identity, this particular insignia, I don't know, the representation of this king or that king, or I think maybe I'm thinking a lot of the character of The Adventures of a Bad Shilling, that the coin character, but I think they would, yeah, laugh at some of our human quibbles, I suppose, which of course to us are such, you know, big topics like national identity and things like that, because coins are ultimately malleable, and that's kind of the thought process that I work through in relation to that story, The Adventures of a Bad Shilling, is that they can be melted down and rebranded, and they can be forged, or they can be you know, mixed with less precious metals and then have less value. But I think there's also something, you know, like how when you travel, you like save other currencies of coins, the change that you come back with. There's a way in which they can often be translated into sentimental or symbolic value too, not just monetary value. So I think for that reason, yeah, coins have very much, I think they would talk about ex their experience and their travels, which is really what happens in The Adventures of a Bad Shilling, is because they seem to have life experience as they go back and forth between human hands and jump on ships or whatever they do. So.
No, I absolutely like I reach into bags all the time and come up with like a euro or a Japanese coin, no currency. I don't even know where it's from. Yeah, absolutely. Could you briefly tell us about this? Like, it seems just like a brilliant read, The Adventures of a Bad Shilling in the Kingdom of Ireland. Like, just a brief summary and then
Sure.
how it fits into your argument.
Oh, happily. Yeah. Unfortunately, it wasn't actually finished because it came out periodically in two different magazines. Well, it's the same magazine, but it changed name over time, called Ireland's Mirror, which was a short-running magazine coming out of Dublin at sort of the turn of the 19th century. So it was never finished, and the author is still anonymous. I guess sometimes I try to conjecture who it might be, but I think it's really impossible to know, unfortunately. But the story is thus: so a man is walking along in Dublin, right near Trinity College, if you've ever been to Trinity College, and he hears someone speak to him, and he looks around and he sees a little speck on the ground, and he picks it up, and it's a talking coin. And the coin says to the man, "Go ahead and sit down as I tell you my story, my long story." And the coin story aligns with the story of Ireland and the story of Ireland's cultural material degradation. So it starts with the coin existing as a beautiful pagan statue. And then after there's some kind of war between clans or chieftains, eventually the coin gets stolen as a statue. It gets melted down and rebranded into a Gaelic torque, or like a bracelet that you put up high on your arm near your bicep, which is a specifically sort of Gaelic aspect of dress. And then it's buried with a Gaelic princess for many, many centuries. And then it sort of lives life in her tomb while Ireland's being colonized above ground. And so then a tenant plowboy comes along, and he somehow unearths the tomb and also the torque or the bracelet. And he doesn't recognize its value. So this is sort of a reference of like how the great culture of Ireland has disappeared because now this Irish descendant doesn't recognize the value of his native culture. And it's taken from him by an Anglo-Irish landlord. Sorry, like you can really use the summary. It's hard to summarize. We wind up going really long. Anyway, I'll try to speed it up. It gets melted down, rebranded into a chalice for a Catholic mass that's given by an Anglo-Irish landlord to his Catholic tenants, and this sort of act of peace, which is meant to reflect sort of Anglo-Irish and Irish nationalism together, which happened at the end of the 18th century. And then in the last couple installments, it goes back into a sad life in that it gets stolen again from it's stolen many, many times, which is sort of an allusion to again that material cultural degradation and dispossession too, I think, national dispossession. So it gets stolen again and then melted down and rebranded and mixed with other various metals into a base shilling, a false shilling, which was very common issue in 18th century Ireland anyway. False coins were happening a lot. And then it, as a base shilling, it goes and it winds up in the pocket of a prostitute. And then presumably some other very bad things happened to it. And then it wound up just on the ground where the narrator at the beginning, it was not even really a narrator, the fella at the beginning of the story finds the coin again. Oh, yeah, sorry. It's one of those like 18th century texts tend to be like long and rambling and you're doing circles and backflips to follow the plot. So, and then yeah, you asked how it fits into my wider argument. I think it sort of represents something that I'm tracing in Swift from earlier in the century, which is that the material make of a coin is a fitting metaphor for national loss, national devaluation, national dispossession. So those who know Swift or who are Swiftians will remember, of course, his famous Drapier's letters about Wood's halfpence. So that's kind of like the most famous coin in Irish literature, right? The halfpence, which or the halfpenny that got everybody up in arms in early 18th century Ireland because of the patent was given to an Englishman rather to an Irishman, and this was considered sort of a bit of economic injustice, essentially. So Swift has his very funny Drapier's letters about the sort of the sin of letting this patent go to William Wood and how it's going to devalue Irish coinage and the Irish economy and by extension the Irish nation and Irish culture. And I think that's what The Adventures of a Bad Shilling is doing, but in a sort of really more profound way. So it's kind of a silly tale, or it's a little bit like overly sentimentalized and tongue in cheek. But at the same time, it's referencing not only this Swiftian tradition of talking about nationalism through coins or through economy, but also an Irish language form of poetry, which is known as the Aisling. And in that poem, they were written in Irish from sort of late 17th century through to the late 18th century. It was a very, very famous form of primarily oral poetry in 18th century Ireland. And in that tale, a woman representing Ireland is sort of kidnapped. Sometimes it's implied that she's sexually assaulted by sort of the Orange King or William of Orange. And It has a lot of the same tropes that The Adventures does. So, the man appears at the beginning and he sees the apparition. In the Aschling, it's a beautiful woman. In The Adventures of a Batchling, it's a ugly coin or it's a dirty coin. So there's some kind of commentary there. So it's really kind of a really hybridized text, The Adventures of a Batchling, because it's referencing the Aschling. It's drawing on this wider discourse in which the metaphor of coin represents a lot of just sort of, I guess, various colonial sins that are going on at the time.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like the coin speaks to like the illusory desire for us to like impose value on things, while at the same
Yes.
time we're misrepresenting the real value of our matter or nation or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. And yeah, I think that the metaphor that The Adventures draws, which is that it links sort of the metal of the coin with the flesh of the Aschling woman, is kind of very salient. So again, on the surface, it might seem like a bit more of a silly or quite a trippy tale, but I think underlying its message is a little bit more serious, as are a lot of things with Irish literature, and certainly that's a Swiftian trait too.
One of the things I loved about this book is the way you are exploding matter outward to show us how it drives our imaginative lives. In chapter two on flax, you look at linen as a material semiotic object, one that mediates colonial thinking about Ireland, while at the same time furnishing a conceptual vocabulary for anti-colonialism. What made linen manufacture such a powerful metaphor for justifying colonial violence? And how was flax such a slippery metaphor that could be put to other purposes?
Thank you for that question. It's a really generous question, actually, because it lets me talk about some of the, I guess, the bigger arguments that I make in the book. You asked earlier, how did I come across my objects? There was no way I was going to avoid the linen manufacturer in when writing about 18th century Ireland, just because it was the main industry, without a doubt. In some cases, people would say the only industry or a proto industry. So there's a common argument in Irish studies that Ireland didn't really experience a consumer revolution or an industrial revolution, but the linen industry is the one area where it sort of did, although it was primarily localized up in Ulster in the north of Ireland. So I think I was just like, okay, I have to write about linen. I'll look into this a little bit more. And using my approach, I was like, okay, I'll look at the material details to see if there's anything there. And interestingly enough, it was as I was looking at sort of the material qualities of flax itself, of sort of like the very base plant that makes a good sheet of linen, a good fine sheet of linen. And when I learned about flax, I realized a lot of things about the Irish character that I had been noticing just in sort of the literary cultural constructions. So, for example, flax is quite viscous. It can hold a lot of water. It's also obviously very, very fine and can be really stretched out into these thin, sort of delicate string. So that kind of reflected to me the way that over the course of the 18th century, as opposed to early modern Ireland, as you'll know about, the Irish character was increasingly feminized and depicted as sort of a, not necessarily completely passive, but like more of a docile, I suppose, feminine image, so as to kind of, pull back the fangs of the colonial other, so to speak. And then at the same time, flax also had to be bleached. So it's not naturally white, it's brown, but linen, for whatever reason, has to be white. It carries this cultural idea of cleanliness and Britain and sort of the wider Western world, certainly. And the way that it's bleached, as I looked more into like the material chemical process of it, is actually quite violent. So in the sense that it's very degrading toward the plant itself, it's really it's sort of like attacks the matter of the flax fiber. So I just thought that was an interesting sort of affording metaphor for me in thinking about how the 18th century does kind of gloss over a lot of the violence from early modern Ireland into sort of a happy Anglo-Irish package tied with a bow in a lot of ways. But if you look at things with greater detail or with a closer microscope or whatever, there is the violence is still very much there, and it's just underneath the surface, which is kind of what the situation with flax is. So flax and linen became sort of this, you know, again, to use that word you mentioned, ubiquitous object. So, you know, it was everywhere. Everybody was participating, not everybody, but almost everybody was participating in the linen trade, whether it was the landlords supplying spinning wheels to their tenants so that they could spin flax. That was going on all across the country. Men migrating to various cities, especially Belfast and Lisburn, to become weavers, spinners in every house, every great house across the nation. And then you had your merchants selling flax the various linen halls. And then, of course, it would migrate. It would be sent over to England and to the Americas as a sort of quite eventually by the end of the 18th century, a very sought after material object or consumer item. So it has, it's everywhere. And yet I felt like its story was really important. And by reading the materiality of flax, I was able to see a sort of a wider cultural pattern happening. So it's kind of, it sounds a bit cheesy, but it wasn't that I realized that flax was a good way to think about Irishness or Irish change. It kind of told me, and it's, again, it sounds kind of cheesy, but I feel like the materiality actually spoke to me and allowed me to see those patterns rather than the other way around.
Yeah. I learned these two words from your book. I hope I'm scutching.
Yeah, scutching, yeah.
Beedling? Is
yeah.
That right?
Oh, the scutching and the beedling, exactly, yeah.
And they seem, yeah, quite violent and quite physically demanding, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the beedling and the scutching are two steps that come before the flax can be prepared to be spun out into the thread. And so yet the beedling is quite literally like a violent just beating up of the flax stalk to sort of make it more pliable. And then the scutching is when you take a long blade and you scutch off the edge of the exterior hard part of the flax fiber. So actual violence has to be done to the flax plant in a lot of ways, both with the scutching and the beetling, and then with the bleaching as well. So it deserves a lot of violent treatment to be made into that fine, beautiful linen thread and linen cloth, which to me just spoke to what colonialism does, right? You have to use violence to make a fine, docile, obedient colonial subject.
Right, and it gets into that whole that metaphorical network of like improvement and mm-hmm. cultivation that operate in the colonial imagination, right?
Right, yeah, especially the British colonial project is so obsessed with improvement, and if you look a little bit more closely at that word improvement, which seems like a very good or even banal word, there's actually some violence at the heart or the origin of it.
You also talk about songs as a medium for a quiet, constrained subversion mm-hmm. for the women who worked in linen manufacture. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I actually have to thank one of my anonymous readers of the manuscript for this, whoever he or she may be. Thank you. They directed me to sort of explore that genre a little bit more, especially because it wasn't as known to me, because song is obviously a sort of an ephemeral thing. And then at the same time, these were all songs written in Irish, so they weren't recorded down everywhere or put into written form at all. But thanks to other Irish-speaking scholars and musicologists who I draw on in the chapter, there is a small body of work that talks about this song tradition. And it's in Scottish culture too. It seems kind of, sort of pastoral or obvious when you think about it, but yeah, women sang as they spun flax thread because it's a time-consuming process. It takes, in many cases, it would take them all day. So sometimes women would get together in a local barn and they would spin together. They would prepare flax together. It became kind of a communal practice, and songs often went along with that. So the song is kind of the antithesis to a lot of the more official records on how to improve linen that were written by folks like Robert Stevenson in Ulster. The song is kind of this, it was this, I guess this way for Irish women to be a little cheeky and to have a bit of fun as they were passing time spinning flax. So a lot of them, a lot of the songs are in the genre would sort of make fun of maybe a man in town, or some of them would be like a parody on a love song. And so it was kind of a place for them to upend sort of the standards of the day, whether those be the sort of the national hierarchies or the gendered ones. It sort of became this little space for a song to be there for female ears and then to kind of just disappear. And yeah, we're just lucky that a few of these songs have been remembered over time, like Unturning Lawn, which is one you can listen to on YouTube even.
Sydney Owenson is a writer that gets reevaluated over the course of the book.
Yeah.
I learned from your book that Owenson created a different kind of literary subjectivity, a mode that was treated hostilely in the 19th century by critics such as Jane Austen and Maria Edgeworth. How was Owenson's approach to literary craft different, and why is it important to recover that model?
Yeah. Oh, I love Sydney Owenson. She's my gal. I love any chance to talk about her. I suppose in another version of doing my PhD, I would have just written a book about her. But yeah, she's kind of the radical of the sort of 19th century women's writing in Ireland. So Maria Edgeworth, obviously everybody will be more familiar with Maria Edgeworth, novels like Castle Rackrent, Ennui, Patronage, those. And she was very much from the establishment, but with a good intention. She wanted to see Irish tenants and Irish Catholics have a better way of life, but she very much believed in the Anglo-Irish paternalistic project, that it was a landlord's duty to take care of the poor and to take care of the less educated and so on. Sydney Owenson did not have such delicate or accepted beliefs at the time. She was much more radical. She wanted rid of English rule entirely in Ireland. She was much more, I guess, with the people or with the tenants. She didn't really speak Irish as well as she claimed to, but she was in all areas kind of subversive in the novels that she wrote, and also in the way that she just sort of lived her life in society. So she was famous, and she's written memoirs about this, for she was quite a party goer, but she would always make statements that were a little bit just subversive, or just had like a bit of a cutting edge to them. So she was a bit more of like the radical antithesis to Maria Edgeworth. But even today, she still gets a really bad rap, because objectively speaking, in terms of what we value in novel writing, her novels aren't, you know, very well written, I suppose. They're not like an Austen novel that you know, deals in the intricate interiority of the human mind. Her novels are a little bit rambling. They're a little bit more like The Adventures of a Bad Shilling of the Kingdom of Ireland. There's a lot of sensationalism. Sometimes it's hard to follow which character is which. So I think she's been really underestimated, because over time the style of her novels have been grouped as overly sentimental or passionate, or like capital R romantic, but in sort of more of a foolish kind of way rather than like a Wordsworthian way. So my argument was just, she's like, oh, she's often been pitched as like, okay, she was the radical political thinker. She was very popular in her day, but that's just because people liked to, you know, read a little bit of that chick lit, basically, or whatever. But I think there's actually a lot to be taken from her stylistically, in terms of the way that she frames human character and human relationships with the sort of the surrounding environment. So she's very much a writer of materials as well as of emotions. So yeah, her language can be flowery, that's true. But I don't think that's what's as important when you look at her works. I think that there's, she is kind of developing a kind of interiority, but I see it as a specific kind of mental interiority that's aware of its own colonial subjection, I suppose. So she also likes to, you know, whereas you'll have someone like Mariah Edgeworth always writing from the perspective of the landlord class, Owenson is more interested in at least giving the sort of the colonial subjects or the tenant Irish voices dialogue, and sometimes they'll even be sort of main characters in her novels. So she has, I guess, more of a liberal mind as a result. But nevertheless, she was always writing for an English audience. She's writing in English, and that's where her novels were very popular. So I sort of see her, her characters not, the way that her characters are not overly personalized, interiorized, you know, the way that you get to know, you feel like you know Elizabeth Bennet, you feel like she's your friend. You don't really get that in Owenson's novels. And my argument is that that's kind of a, I guess, anti-colonial shield in a way. It's a representation of Irish character that doesn't give over everything to the English reader, and intentionally. And that's not a failure in her writing or a failure in her aesthetic in the way that she composes her characters and her plots, but it's actually, if we flip the script on what's good writing, it could be something that's worth celebrating.
In your chapter on Mud, you analyze Mariah Edgeworth's Rosanna.
Yeah.
As a story that narrates the cabin cottage binary. The English live in cottages, a sign of civilization. The Irish live in mud cabins, which are unseemly in their many varieties of messiness, according to Edgeworth. Can you tell us about Edgeworth's story and Mud?
Mm-hmm. So Edgeworth famously, when she first went to Ireland, when she was sort of a preteen, she saw a mud cabin, and in some letters she was horrified at seeing them for the first time. And they do tend to come up in her Irish novels, in Sidney Owenson's novels too, but definitely in Mariah Edgeworth. So most explicitly in Rosanna, because in that story, it's one of her more explicitly or more overtly sort of her pedagogical tales, in which she's giving her reader a lesson, a moral lesson. So in that one, it's that basically you have to be good and clean and do everything you possibly can to keep up good appearances. And if you keep a good home, a good domestic home, then, you know, rewards will come to you, and you'll improve your life and your culture and your civility, etc. So that in that story, basically, a family works hard to get out of their mud cabin status, essentially, and they do. So good for them is sort of the message of that. It makes them, you know, better people. And also, coincidentally, it makes them more English, because at the end, Rosanna, the daughter born in the mud cabin, weds into an English family. So this is kind of like the ultimate reward for her good character and her attempts to be cleanly and good. Edgeworth, I think, is, for, even though I'm sort of a Sidney Owenson fan, Edgeworth, it gives me so much in terms of the material arguments, because I don't think it's necessarily always conscious, but the material world has a real narrative sort of affordance in her writing, and whether she intends to or not, her materiality really speaks. And I think that's especially the case with the mud cabin, not just in the story Rosanna, but also in her novel that's probably more well known, Ennui. And in that story, famously, the main character discovers he too is like Rosanna, the child of the mud cabin. He finds out his real mother was his foster mother, an Irish woman named Eleanor, and she like lives in a mud cabin. And so there's this whole thing where he tries to get her out of the mud cabin and build her another house, and it all, you know, basically goes to hell because the wind and the weather sort of destroys the more civil house that he builds for her. But basically this architecture of, do you live in cob or mud walls, or do you live in good stone slate like the English do, becomes kind of this this language of national difference, and also colonial hierarchy too. And so then I just try to push back. And again, sort of like with the flax, read the mud on its own material terms. Like, okay, yeah, this, it seems really horrendous to live in a house made of mud, but what actually was the material experience like? Is it quite as bad as these writers would lead us to believe, as Edgeworth would lead us to believe, for example? And so I try to say, no, it's not quite that bad.
How did this period's representations of pigs have implications for Irish identity?
Yeah. So the pigs, I really feel like I, in some ways, I didn't write the book. The materials wrote the book, but the pigs sort of demanded their own chapter because I was trying to deal with the pigs in relation to the mud cabin. But the pigs, you know, they wanted a life of their own and their whole story to be told. And it's kind of an anomalous materiality in relation to the others, and that I'm talking about an animal rather than a plant or an organic material matter. Yeah, I think pigs are sort of the easiest way to explain it for like a non-Irish studies audience would be pigs are the sort of like the ape of Irish racialization and British imagery, certainly dating back to the early modern period, but also even more explicitly in the writing, the way that the Irish are quite literally racialized as pigs in cartoons, in things like Punch magazine and early modern prints. There's the most common thing, which is said again and again and again, by Dickens, by a number of people in the 19th century and the 18th century, is that the Irish have like this weird relationship with their pigs. They like to sleep with their pigs. They like to be with their pigs. So therefore they must be pigs, and pigs are the lowliest of meat. And so, you know, the metaphor continues and allusions continue. But again, reading the materiality on its own terms, pigs certainly have a different story to tell if you learn a little bit more about them. And they're actually quite fascinating creatures. I've actually grown very fond of them after writing this book. So, but what was this exactly that you asked me though at the end there about the pigs? I think I got excited talking about my pigs and I forgot.
And pigs are also like really smart, right?
They're very smart. Yeah, they're very intelligent creatures, and they're actually very clean. Even though people are like, oh, they're a dirty animal, because the wallowing in the mud is because they don't sweat, so that like it cools them down. It's kind of their natural solution to sort of body temperature problem. Yes, and they're very clean. Like they're one of few animals that will really demarcate, you know, where they eat and where they go to the bathroom. So that's kind of also makes them cleaner than others.
So what in this imagined representation of pigs, what are the features or qualities that get mapped onto the Irish?
So it's certainly the lack of cleanliness, sort of this base materiality that, so, you know, again, the wallowing in the mud is sort of implied that the Irish wallow in mud too, or they are, have this kind of bestiality out of the soil, like, you know, there's no civility to them. Also this implication of laziness, that the pigs are very lazy, the Irish are lazy, they don't want to work, when really it's actually a landholding system that makes, you know, them, it prevents them from getting any kind of income. The idea that they're kind of stupid or simple. So basically all the bad qualities that pigs have, the Irish have too, and bad qualities in general. So.
Is there also something like a lack of discernment? Because I know
yes.
That, right? Like what's the expression? Pearls before swine or something?
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah, it's funny how that word swine, even though like over time it's gotten such a negative connotation, like it's like the worst kind of insult you can use, but actually, like, you know, historically, I mean, we were just talking about, it's just a name for this animal, but it has this really, really horrific connotation in our regular parlance, and has for a long time. The lack of discernment, they can't really discern the civility in the same ways that the Irish can't. So at least that's what the English try to imply.
Can you read a passage from your book?
Absolutely, yeah. So actually, speaking of the pigs, why not say more about the pigs? And you mentioned Phil Purcell when you were introducing, so I'll read a short passage. This comes from the pigs chapter toward the end. And I'm talking about a story called Phil Purcell, the Pig Driver, written by an Irish Catholic writer, William Carleton. And in this story, an Irish man, Phil Purcell, goes to England to sell a pig. And in the meantime, he winds up fooling some English people. He takes advantage of them, presuming that he is all those qualities we just said, stupid, uncivil, unclean, foolish, and he sort of dupes them. He pulls one over on them. So here goes. What is most significant for this study of Irish materiality and expression, however, is the conclusion to Phil Purcell, the Pig Driver, which points to a shift in the relationship between the workings of an Irish mind and the presumably English reader. Phil Purcell tries to sell his sow in England by marketing her like an Irish servant girl. And I'm not going to try to attempt to do his Anglo-Irish accent here. I'll just read it, his Hiberno-English accent. She is like a Christian, your honor, and no trouble, sir, if you'd be seeing company or anything. She's clean and decent crather, sir. So that's kind of putting on the ridiculous Irish accent there, the paddywhackery, as we call it. Anyway, so back to the text. The personification of the Irish pig highlights the unjust animalization of poor Irish people in English culture. Phil's good humor here, however, becomes cutting when he promises this English customer that he can, quote, in no time put a knife in her when you please. A line that intimates subtextual nationalist critique of ruthless English violence against Ireland based in the longstanding equation of Irish native with the pig ripe for slaughter, dating back to Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal. In his speech, Phil plays the role of the ignorant Irish stereotype, driving his pig up to the house of an Englishman who has no interest in buying her, but he nevertheless begs to show the sow to the mistress. The Englishman's wife and several other ladies come out to view Phil, to view Phil, rather than the pig. They see him as the Irish specimen. In front of Phil, the women discuss that he is actually not ill-looking and his eyes are good, and were it not that his nose is rather short and turned up, he would be human. This scene enacts creative empathy with pigs, imagining what it is like to be within their own interior mind and sensibility, to be sized up and objectified as the English women do to Phil with his inhuman pig's nose. In placing the reader inside the colonial subject's body and perspective, inside the stereotype of the Irishman illustrated as a pig, Carleton's text inhabits the pig's inner subjectivity as well. This moment, blending Phil and his pig in facial features and in colonial anthropomorphic objectification, exerts a deliberate message about the cruelty of prejudice, both nationalist and by default, speciesist.
I'd like to talk about the style of the passage and choices that you made. In particular, I'm interested in how, like, you integrate these textual passages, like you call it the paddy.
Oh, the paddy whackery. Yeah.
How do you sort of integrate that into it? Sometimes with suspicion or with distance, and then sometimes like fully integrating it into your passages. What kinds of stylistic choices do you see in that passage?
No, I just don't know if I reflect on it that much, but I do know one thing that I think when I write, I try to imagine myself teaching. So I try to make it, I think where, like, things where, like, the way I structure a sentence and place commas and dashes and things are very much based on like where I would pause in a sentence. So I think it's very much has, I try to make it have like an audible quality to it. And I don't know if that's just like because of my back, like I used to work in radio for a little while, my background there, but I want it to be, I guess, conversational, but also kind of build. So to move from step to step and sort of bring the reader along with that, while also giving the character of the text itself. Because the thing with this book is, as you pointed out, is a lot of the texts are not really well known. So I have to sort of integrate them, well, and their style or their sort of their character while also summarizing them, because a lot of people won't necessarily know what I'm talking about. So I try to give a little flavor of that, of Phil's humor in the passage, as well as his subversion.
I find that really interesting, what you're saying about like internalizing it, and interlocutor, or you mentioned students, you know, what would they need at this moment, or that sort of thing. Do you read aloud when you're composing?
Yeah, I usually do, but not at the beginning, but when I'm sort of getting to the latter stages of a chapter or an article or something, I do read it aloud, yeah.
Yeah, so reading aloud, are there other techniques, writerly techniques that you have that have been reliable? Are you part of like writing groups or?
Unofficially, yeah. I do always send what I've written to people to read. Usually my first and most important reader is my advisor and mentor, Beth Kolesky Wallace, a former professor of English at Boston College. She's now retired and living a good life as an emerita professor, but she has a really keen eye. So she's a very challenging reader too. So I try to find people that are not just gonna say, oh, this sentence is a little clunky, but this core idea is a problem. Then you know, make me sort of face it that way. And then when you do extensive editing like that, you inevitably end up writing a better piece. So I do a lot of editing.
Stepping back, what do you most value in academic writing? Are there writers that you particularly admire or you've modeled yourself after?
Yeah, I think I really admire clarity. Maybe that's sort of obvious, but I think there's this tendency, especially I read a lot of theory too. So theory tends to be quite dense and use a lot of highfalutin words, as my mother would have said. But I really value kind of like a simple sentence that's just doing the work of conveying information. And I think that simple language can often, you know, really be sort of the foundation of good, elegant writing style. So I tend to admire that. In academic writing. Some academic writers that I really admire, one's Terry Eagleton, just because he's very bold, I think, too, as well in his writing. I just very much admire that. And there's a number of other Irish studies writers that I would really admire. Someone like Declan Kybird, he writes, you know, exquisitely well. Claire Connolly, who's a Burns visiting lecturer at Boston College this year, she is also a phenomenal writer, and I think she kind of really mastered that clarity and quickly conveying a lot of information in a sentence. So I think that's kind of what I admire.
Yeah, and I guess part of that that lack of clarity sometimes in academic writing, I feel sometimes, or at least in my own writing, there's a like a defensiveness there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to state this, like, you know, to psychoanalyze, I guess, to put this claim out there without any of the sartorial defenses of jargon or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like you have to build your armory before you jump into an idea, because you're already anticipating someone being like, no, you didn't read this thing. So, yeah.
Exactly. And I will say Irish Materialisms is such a wonderfully written book. And
thank you.
Your book began as a dissertation.
It did indeed.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the process of writing and revising? What was surprising about that adaptation? And what advice would you give to early career scholars who are writing a dissertation or revising one, or even people who are advising dissertation writers?
Yeah, I think the first piece of advice, and I've given this to a few other postdocs before, is to just take a big break from it. Like after you finish your dissertation, take a good, you know, 3 months at least to not look at it, to not think about it, and then you have to come back to it, because the dissertation is very much a different genre than a book. You have to cut away things like footnotes, some of that defensiveness you were talking about, and I think you have to really figure out like who you are as an academic voice rather than as an extension of your committee's guidance or your committee's approaches. It has to be more, I guess, personal, more about you. Like, you know, what are you saying versus what are you trying to tell your committee with your dissertation? I think my, when I look back on it, it happened very organically, the writing of this book and the revising of it. Again, I sort of, I know it sounds cheesy, but I keep saying that I really let the materiality like sort of guide the narrative path. And I also had to, I guess, be kind of brave and be willing to cut out, just, you know, send stuff to the bin. Like I had a few chapters that, that just weren't as strong, and I had to really let them go, and I had to write new chapters. And that felt really daunting at the time because, you know, you have this big long dissertation with your five chapters or whatever, and you're like, oh my God, I'm going to just get rid of a whole one and write a whole new one and research a whole new one. And it felt really overwhelming, but I stopped myself from thinking about the magnitude of it and just, again, like kind of went along with the story of the materiality. And I think as a result, those are actually my strongest chapters, because I intentionally didn't put the pressure on myself with it as I did with my dissertation and with some of those other chapters. I was kind of just like, oh, I guess I'll just, you know, write this chapter about mud. This could be curious. Wait, this could be weird. I'll just see where this goes. And then it wound up like, you know, being actually my favorite chapter in the book. So yeah, I think you have to just kind of be willing to have some bravery to take a step back. And also, like, you know, I'm really in favor of that autobiographical preface, I guess, now, or sort of this personal declaration, because I think it helped me to articulate what my book was actually about. So that's another thing I would, you know, I would advise someone to do, not necessarily to publish it, but just to kind of crystallize, you know, what your voice is and what your bigger project is.
I love that idea of writing a memoir or something, you know, something, even if you decide it doesn't go in the book, but just explaining why it's personal. That's
right.
Cool. And just to circle back, you said part of the revision process is like, you know, claiming an authentic voice.
Mm.
Or like, you know, separating yourself from your advisors or, you know, what influences you might have. How did you go about that?
Yeah, I think one of it has to deal with just like I changed the tone a lot in the chapter. So I went from being like proving I had read the thing or proving I knew how to engage with all the bigger, wider scholarly argument to just being, again, almost like that teacherly mode, like, oh, this is a curious question. What happens when we follow this question to this various archive, to this text, to this other question, to this material evidence? So I think I changed my voice and my tone from one of, the sort of like that defensiveness or showcasing what I knew to returning to a kind of almost like childlike curiosity, like, oh, that's kind of weird. Like, you know, what happens when we follow that really strange question? And that wound up sort of being kind of the tone and the effort of the book, I think, which is just to ask kind of crazy questions and see where the material takes you.
And giving yourself permission to,
yes,
you know, even, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Can you tell us a little bit about any projects you might be working on? Like, what's next? Book, an article, or a hobby? You know, a novel you're excited about?
So I'm working on a new project, which I think will be a book. Not working on it as effectively as I would hope, because I just had a baby, so she's sort of taking up my time more so than writing and researching. But I'm working on a Blue Humanities project, so sort of as a connection or as a, I guess, cousin to New Materialism. I started to read some Blue Humanities material, and that really excited me. So I've started to craft a Blue Humanities project, kind of similar to this book, in that I'm dealing with, I'm writing about literature, but writing about literature through focuses that are not like an author or a text, but it's like an ecosystem, essentially, or a species or something. So the one piece I have written is a chapter on seals, And the idea of the Selkie or the seal woman in Irish and Scottish folklore, I don't know if you know the story, but a seal comes on land and sheds skin and becomes a woman and falls in love with a person on land, but then finds the seal skin again and then has to return to the sea. This common folk tale. So it's increasingly this book, I think, is going to be about folklore more so than anything I've ever written before. So that's kind of a whole new realm for me to explore. But yeah, I'm pretty excited about it, and I'm learning a lot about the ocean. So that's a nice upside too.
Very cool. Any texts that might be familiar to us or
As of now, no, it's really very strongly folklore or just like literary like versions of the folklore primarily. But I am going to do a chapter on shipwrecks, I think. So that will be some more obvious things. And I'm sure I'm gonna have to deal with Gulliver's Travels. So that's gonna be there somewhere, for better or for worse. So
We'll keep our eyes out for that project as
thank
it
you.
emerges, you know. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Colleen.
Thank you, John. This was loads of fun. I had a really great time, and you asked such wonderful questions. So thank you so much.